the case of Stauffer versus Henderson. We will now hear from petitioner.
May please the court, Mr. William Rivers, and Mr. Arnold, please. This case involves a dispute between a sister, two sisters, who established an account for interstate savings and loans, a joint account. And the party who deposited the funds shortly thereafter died, and the sister remaining, the petitioner in this case, withdrew the funds, and the executor of this estate, the respondent, filed suit in conversion to have the funds placed under the jurisdiction of the probate court in the state. Both parties in this case filed motions for summary judgment in the trial court. The petitioner seeking to have the account determined as a joint tenancy with rights of survivorship as a matter of law, and the respondent filing a motion for summary judgment to have the account established as a joint account only with no survivorship rights as a matter of law. The respondent's motion for summary judgment was granted by the trial court and affirmed by the Court of Appeals in Amarillo, which effectively presents the issue as to what is necessary under the current status of the law to establish a joint tenancy of rights of survivorship.
Really are no fact issues to be determined here. Just
no fact issues. Well, we basically everything was stipulated by stipulation. The petitioner put no funds into the account, which was stipulated, and withdrew the funds from the account after the death of her sister. Prior to 1979, based upon the foundation that this court established in the case of Kruger versus Williams in 1962, the law was fairly well settled and fairly clear and simple, although the application was fairly difficult. The law being that payable to a survivor in a joint account was evidence of the intent to establish a survivorship account and created a presumption that the party intended the account to survive to the remaining parties to the account, and allowed parole evidence to vary the terms of the contract and even to contradict the express terms of the account. Then, in 1979, Chapter 11 to the Probate Code was enacted. The House Judicial Affairs Committee's minutes and the Senate and Jurisprudence Committee minutes are cited in response brief on page 9 and 10, and tend to indicate that the legislature intended to create a simple scheme of joint accounts that would allow persons to establish an account and to have their intent carried out in the establishment of the account. Whereas under the prior law, each case depended upon the factual issues as what the intent of the parties establishing the account were. I think it was the legislature's intent to do away with those factual issues and make it as a matter of law. In fact, as quoted in the intent was to do away with the magic words and say to allow a layperson who is dealing with a unschooled person in a financial institution and setting up an account to, in fact,
create the type of account and have the intended results that they wanted to have without the requirements of litigation in the future. What they did is they established a scheme of multi-party accounts, the first of which is a joint account, which was defined, which does not change the beneficial ownership of the funds in the account, allows each party to the account access to the funds, and does not change beneficial ownership of the funds upon the death of any of the parties. Beneficial ownership then being defined under the code as in proportion to the net contribution of each depositor, unless a contrary intent is shown. Then they established, that's the first part of their scheme. The second part of the scheme is a POD account, payable on death account, which does not change the beneficial ownership of the account during a lifetime that belongs to the person who is the payee of the account. And then that person designates a payee on death. And in under the Chapter 11, what is necessary to transfer ownership of that account to the survivor is only the death of the POD payee. So that is a payable on death account, which requires only the designation of a beneficiary to receive the funds after death. Then the third type of account in the scheme that they established was the survivorship account, which does not change the beneficial ownership of the funds during the lifetime of the parties, but upon death, transfers the ownership of the funds to the survivor. Death of one of the parties transfers the ownership to the survivor. Then they attempted to distinguish the survivorship account from a strict joint account. And they did that by making three requirements. One is that it be an agreement in writing. And two is it must be signed by the deceased party. And three is it must make the interest of the deceased party survive to the survivor. Then they further clarified, the legislature further clarified, which is not an issue in this particular case, in 1987, what words were, or gave an example of what words were necessary to cause the interest to be transferred. And in 1987, they added that to 439A, if the agreement states in substantially the following form, on death of one party to the joint account, all sums in the account on the day of death vest in and belong to the surviving party as his or her separate property and estate. So, we have the prior law, which payable on, the words payable on death were not sufficient to conclusively establish a survivorship account, but all courts agreed that it was evidence of the intent to cause the funds to survive. And we had the prior law that stated that parole evidence was admissible to vary the terms of the agreement, even contradict the express terms of the agreement. Then the courts of appeal have begun interpreting Chapter 11. In the Sheffield versus Dozier case and the Otto versus Clement case, they established that parole evidence was not admissible with respect to intent when a joint tenancy with right of survivorship was conclusively established. In In other words, if the magic words joint tenancy with rights of survivorship was on the agreement, then no evidence is admissible to vary that. That implicitly establishes a survivorship of him. So then the issue became, what is sufficient to establish, conclusively establish, a survivorship of Cam? Well, in the Chopin case, the Dallas Courts has taken a very strict construction, stating that essentially, and the commentators have essentially interpreted the Chopin case to say that it must contain the magic words, joint tenancy with rights of survivorship. I did not read the Chopin case to be that strict. It says it must contain words, joint tenancy with rights of survivorship, or words to that effect, which brings into play what the legislature has downdone by the amendment to 439A. They are not requiring an amendment, the 1987 amendment, the magic words joint tenancy with rights of survivorship. They're only requiring words to that effect. Then the Houston court, in the Sawyer versus Lancaster case, came along and said that Chapter 11 did in fact prevent and preclude the introduction of any evidence to vary the terms of the contract if a joint tenancy account was conclusively established. But if a joint tenancy with rights of survivorship was not conclusively established, then the prior law that payable to the survivor created a presumption of survivorship that could be overcome by evidence. And the Sawyer Court now says that evidence can be presented to establish intent if the account does not conclusively establish a survivorship account. Then this case was presented to the Amarillo Court with essentially the same question. The Amarillo Court, following the Chopin Court, has said that evidence is not admissible whether or in any event. If an account does not conclusively establish a survivorship account, then it conclusively, as a matter of law, establishes a joint account without rights of survivorship.
Counsel, I've forgotten, were these funds in this account community property of Mr. Henderson, or were they her separate funds?
Well, the issue of the community funds has actually been severed out of this case at the present time. And there were some community funds. The amount of the community funds is probably still in controversy.
That's not before us yet.
That's correct. That issue was severed out so that we could get a determination of whether or not the account was actually a survivorship account, or whether or not it became under the control of the probate officer.
Well, assuming we agree with you, does that moot the other question?
No, I think it presents a question, another question. First of all, what portion of the funds were community, and even if it is a survivorship account, then a husband is going to be entitled to that portion, his community portion of the funds. If it is determined that it's not a community, a survivorship account, then the account as a whole will go under the administration of the court. The issue of community property will be presented in the distribution. The Sawyer Court in Houston criticizes the opinion of the Chopin, the Dallas Chopin opinion, and I think probably correctly so, in that the foundation for the opinion of the Chokin case was the prior law that the words payable to the survivor, taken out of the, they primarily relied on the Krueger, the Krueger case, that said payable to the survivor was not sufficient to establish a survivorship account. But then the Chokin court did not consider that that rule was that it was not, that they didn't consider the whole rule. They just considered part of it. They just considered the part that says the mere words payable to the survivor is not sufficient to establish survivorship account. But in the Krueger case and all those cases that were handed down after the Krueger case and prior to 1979, followed that up with, but it is intent that the parties intended, evidence of intent that the parties intended a survivorship account, and that it created a presumption. Of course, the presumption, I think, is of survivorship that can be overcome by evidence. That's the whole rule. The Chokin court didn't consider that whole rule, and that's the fallacy of the opinion. The Sawyer court also didn't consider that rule as a whole was probably abolished by the enactment of Chapter 11. When Chapter 11 was enacted, the 439A was enacted, it was taken primarily from the Model Probate Code, but in the Model Probate Code, it stated that if it is a joint account, it will be a survivorship account unless clear and convincing evidence is shown to the contrary. Well, the legislature left out the clear and convincing evidence in adopting 439A. The bottom line is that in the Amarillo court, in the opinion in this case, they say that we are working under a contract theory to determine the survivorship, and that we must consider the intent of the parties from the contract itself without further evidence. But then they neglected to recognize that all of the courts have recognized that the words payable to the survivor is evidence of the intent of the parties. And therefore, if the account card has payable to the survivor to it, contained in it, that is the only intent that is shown on the contract. So, and the legislature also recognized that in when they established the POD account, that all that is necessary to make a survivorship in a POD account is that the funds be payable to the POD payee upon the death of the account holder. So the question then becomes, is payable to the survivor sufficient to satisfy the requirements of 439A that a writing be made to transfer the ownership of the funds on the death of one of the parties? And it is my position that when Chapter 11 was enacted, that it abolished the prior law, but it did not abolish the prior principle that payable to the survivor alone, those words alone, are evidence of the intent of the parties to establish a survivorship account. I think that, as I say, the legislature has recognized that as sufficient in the POD account, the layperson dealing with an unschooled person establishing an account would normally assume that if an account is payable to another person, that ownership of that non-title personal property is transferred with transfer of the possession of the property. So if the legislature's intent is that a person can establish a joint account and know what the results of establishing that account are going to be, then payable to the survivor would necessarily have to be sufficient to transfer ownership of the property. If you say payable to the survivor is not sufficient to establish a survivorship account under 439A, then you are creating another type of account which was not contemplated by the scheme in Chapter 11. Because then you have created an account that during the lifetime of a party, it is accessible by either of the parties, beneficial ownership not being changed, but on death of one of the parties, the survivor has a right to possession of the funds, but not ownership. And if a person has right to possession of funds, which all of the courts agree that it's payable to the survivor, and the Chokin Court expressly held with respect to the question of prejudgment interest, and the Amarillo Court followed that in our case, where the trial court had awarded prejudgment interest on the funds and stating conclusively that any party to the account had rights to possession, therefore prejudgment interest was not proper. What good is possession of the funds of an account if you have no ownership of it and you cannot use or benefit from those funds? To me, it makes no sense to have a person who is entitled to possession of money but no use of the money. And that's what it is determined payable to the survivor is not sufficient to transfer ownership. In this particular case, the account card, I think, is set out in whole in our application on page 7 and 8 of our application. In this case, we have an agreement which is much stronger with respect to the transfer of ownership of the funds than any of the accounts which have been considered in the previously considered by the courts since the enactment of Chapter 11. Not only in this case does the account card specifically make any property in the account the joint property of the parties. It specifically states that the funds deposited in this account are and shall be our joint property, and that either of us shall have the power to act in all matters relating to such accounts, whether the other be living or dead, and that upon the death of either of us, any balance in said account or any part thereof may be withdrawn by or upon the other or the survivor. It is especially agreed that withdrawal of the funds by the survivor shall be binding upon us and upon our heirs, our next of kin, legatees, assigned, and personal representatives. So even if the words payable to the survivor, which this account has, is not sufficient to establish a survivorship account, in our case, the account card is sufficient under the 439A in that it specifically expresses an intent to transfer ownership of the property. Number one, it's payable to the survivor, That is evidence of intent. Number two is that it is the withdrawal is binding upon all heirs, representatives, and assigns, so therefore no one can complain. So it is my position that even if payable to the survivor is not sufficient, then our account card is sufficient under 439A. Therefore, we would respectfully request that the Court of Appeals decision be reversed and judgment be rendered in that this account, in this case, is a joint tenancy of the rights of survivorship, therefore passing outside of the probate state to the survivor.
Any questions? Thank you, Counsel. We'll now hear arguments from respondents.
May I please the Court, Mr. Mitchell Ehrlich and Mr. John Brown will present argument from respondents. Mr. Ehrlich, welcome.
May it please the Court. My name is Mitchell Ehrlich. I practice law in Perryton. I, along with Mr. Brown, seated to my right, represents J.D. Henderson. Mr. Henderson filed suit against Mary Stauffer, seeking to impose a constructive trust on the proceeds and also seeking a personal judgment for conversion of those funds when they were withdrawn from an interstate savings and on the passbook account. The trial court determined as a matter of law that the proceeds of the interstate savings and loan account were a joint account only as a matter of law. The trial court ruled that a joint tenancy with right of survivorship was not established as a matter of law. The issues, there were other issues relating to whether the property was a community property or a separate property of Mrs. Henderson. Those issues were severed for trial at a later date. The only issue that was determined so that the case could be appealed was the characterization of the account as being a joint tenancy with right of survivorship or a joint account. Trial court found it's a joint account only. That decision has been affirmed. The Supreme Court has granted writ on 2 points, and the 2 points deal with the matter of law points, and that is they can basically be summarized as one issue, and that is, did the language of the interstate savings and loan account establish a joint tenancy with right of survivorship as a matter of law, or did it establish only a joint account only as a matter of law? Those were the points of error that were raised by the court. Mr. Rivers has argued his point three, which was not granted on the rebuttable presumption issue. Prior to the Henderson decision by the Amarillo Court of Civil Appeals, there were three guidelines that the court had in determining the characterization of the funds in an account such as this. The three guidelines were very clear. Those were as follows. The language payable to the survivor in a joint account was not, as a matter of law, sufficient to establish a joint tenancy with right of survivorship account. The courts clearly held that when you only have those words, payable to the survivor, you have a joint account only as a matter of law. The second parameter that the courts have used is the language, the words, that the court, since Kruger versus Williams, this court has since Kruger versus Williams has used, if you use the words joint tenancy with right of survivorship, and you put those words on the account card, as a matter of law, you have established a joint tenancy with right of survivorship. That case law, contrary to Mr. Rivers' statement, has continued to the present time and was not changed by the enactment of the changes brought to the legislature in 1979. The third parameter that was decided is the legislature in 1979 enacted for the first time a comprehensive provision to deal with multi-party accounts. And in that legislation, they enacted Section 439A. They said in that provision that in order to have a survivorship account, the language must be made to survive to the surviving party. What happened in 1987 was that the legislature saw that there were some problems being created, and they wanted to give some guidance to courts on the language that would be sufficient and would suffice to establish a joint tenancy with right of survivorship. The legislature said if you use these words, and I call them the safe harbor words, safe harbor rule, if you use these words and you put them into a joint tenancy in an account card, you have established a joint tenancy with right of survivorship. And that was only effective on August 31st, 1987. Our position is the language of the account card doesn't even come close to complying with what the legislature stated in 1987 would be sufficient. And that is that on the death of the survivor, the property remaining on hand in the account will vest to and belong to the surviving party as his or her separate property and estate. And if you put that language in the account card, then you have a joint tenancy with right of survivorship as a matter of law. Now, the history before the decision that is before the court started with Kruger versus Williams, where this court has held the words payable to survivor are not sufficient to establish a joint tenancy. We have the legislative enactment of Section 439A. The enactment said the account language must be made to survive. The next decision that we had on this issue started with the Chopin case, Chopin versus Inter First Bank case in Dallas. So that court held correctly that language payable to the survivor is insufficient to establish a joint tenancy of right of survivorship. They said that alone only establishes a joint account. That case has been followed by San Antonio Court of Appeals in McGee versus Westmoreland. Incidentally, it has also been followed by the Sawyer versus Lancaster case, upon which Mr. Rivers argues in his point that there's a presumption of intent to create a survivorship. The Sawyer court expressly holds that that language is insufficient to establish the joint tenancy with right of survivorship. The Amarillo court has followed all of the decisions correctly, has rejected any presumption of intent to create a survivorship just by those words alone. I would like to next address the language of the Interstate Savings and Loan Association account card itself. The language of the account card itself, the title of the account is very interesting. What does it say? It says joint account payable to either or survivor. The title of the account clearly shows it was a joint account only. The language payable to the survivor, that is in there. That is insufficient to establish a joint tenancy. There is language in the account card that states, this property, all deposits put into this account shall remain our, quote, joint property, quote. What do they mean by joint property, quote? Our position is that is, we have no quarrel with the fact that that was a joint, that that was their joint property during their lifetime. The probate code, in enacting the multi-party account legislation in 1979, specifically allows for joint property. And that joint property, as a joint account, is defined in Section 436.4 of the probate code. It defines a joint account as an account created by two or more parties that's payable on demand to either person without, regardless of whether there's survivorship provisions. The probate code specifically allows for joint accounts. And Section 438A states that the property in that account is owned during their lifetimes by those persons who have contributed funds to the account. So the probate code specifically allows for the establishment of joint accounts. What we have in the Interstate Savings and Loan Association is the establishment of a joint account. The next part of the language of the Interstate Savings and Loan Account upon which the petitioner relies is the withdrawal language. And the language in the Interstate Savings and Loan Association states that the withdrawals by the survivor shall be binding upon the heirs and their successors and assigns. Withdrawal. The word withdrawal means to take possession of the account in question. And there is nothing inconsistent with what we are saying as far as the characterization of the account, and that language is clearly insufficient to vest ownership in Mrs. Stouffer. And the question is, what happened when she withdrew the account? Nothing happened. She had possession of the money, and she committed no wrong. She had possession of it, but she did commit a wrong when Mr. Henderson, in his capacity as the executor of his wife's estate, told Mrs. Stouffer, "I want the money now. It is mine. The ownership is mine. You haven't established a joint tenancy with buyer survivorship account. I want the money back into the estate." So the key point on the withdrawal is there's nothing wrong with her withdrawing the funds, and the account specifically says that that's binding upon the people. Taking of the possession is clearly allowed, and she is insulated from liability. She's not insulated from liability when the ownership rightfully belongs to someone else. And when demand was made on it, she committed a conversion, and Mr. Henderson brought suit for conversion and obtained a judgment against her for the account balance. You contrast the language that is set forth in Section 439A, which the legislature in 1987 enacted, with the language in the Interstate Savings and Loan Association account, and you can see on its face that what you have is a joint account only. There's nothing in the Interstate Savings and Loan account that talks about vesting. There's nothing in the account that talks about the property belonging to it. The language is clearly consistent with the creation of a joint account. They created a joint account. Mrs. Stouffer only had the right to possession of it. And at this time, if the court doesn't have any further questions, I would like to turn the argument over to Ms. Brown.
May it please the court. In Mr. Rivers' opening argument to this court, he made two significant points that we need to address. First of all, he made much of the fact that the intent of the parties was significant in determining the character of a multi-party account for the enactment of Chapter 11 of the Probate Code in 1979. He then made much of the fact that the courts have struggled with the notion of parole evidence in determining what these account cards mean. I submit to this court that neither of those points are before this court for decision. Both points of error, which this court has granted writ, speak to a determination of the character of the account as a matter of law. And the issues before this court do not involve the intent of the party. We're determining whether the account card in question makes this account a joint account or a survivorship account as a matter of law. I think this court in this decision has the opportunity to clarify an area of law which, despite the legislature's intent to try to do that, has remained quite chaotic. I think embrace the petitioner's position that this account card creates a survivorship account would continue to create confusion in this area. Basically, what the petitioner would want this court to do is instruct the lower courts and the people of the state dealing with these matters that every time an account card comes in issue, we have to sit down, we have to look at it, we have to compare it with prior court decisions, we have to compare it with the statute, we look at the language, try to determine, is this step over the line and make it a survivorship account? Is this language sufficiently different from language that's been considered by so many courts in the state? And does that distinguish this account from the accounts that have been previously decided? I submit that that's not the law, and that should not be the law. I'm reminded of Mr. Justice Spears' comment this morning in our first oral argument before the court about the hue and cry over litigation in this state and the cost of litigation. And I submit that this court's embracing the petitioner's position in this case would do exactly that, would create more litigation. Whereas to affirm the Court of Appeals and trial court would provide certainty, predictability to financial institutions for purposes of non-testamentary dispositions. We are submitting to this court the notion that a strict statutory construction is required in determining the character of these accounts. We think Chapter 11 of the Code demands no less. I think the enactment of Probate Code Section 439 in 1979 was an attempt to deal with the problems that these accounts created up until that time. And in 1987, the legislature again looked at this issue and saw that it hadn't gotten the job done and tried again. And what did they do? They specifically added language to the statute which, if used, would create a survivorship account. I think one of the most important arguments that was made in the trial court and most persuasive was the fact that if this was to be a joint tenancy with right of survivorship account, why didn't the card say that? Banks typically have different types of cards for different types of accounts. And if this was a survivorship account, it was easy to say that. Kruger versus Williams tells us that the language in this card doesn't work. Then why use it? Why create the problem? If this is intended to be a survivorship account, then it would have been very easy to use a form that would do exactly that.
Counsel, if you look at the form, tell me if it didn't accomplish just what you're saying, that it does not. The top very first line says joint account payable to either or survivor.
Absolutely.
And you get into the actual language. It says, and then upon the death of either of us, any balance in said account or any part thereof may be withdrawn or upon the order provided.
Your Honor, I think you're absolutely right. And I think that's what the cases have told us, that language is absolutely not sufficient.
You're saying it relates to possession, not ownership.
Absolutely, Your Honor. There's a distinct difference between ownership and possession. And we don't argue that Mrs. Stouffer had the right to possession. Chopin, McGee, Sawyer, and this case all say the same thing. We're distinguishing between ownership and possession, and that's what that language does. And I would refer the court to Section 436.4 of the Probate Code, which defines a joint account. And I submit to you that code section, when read in conjunction with the language in this card, makes it quite clear that this is a joint account and not a survivorship account. Let me say this. If stare decisis means anything, it means exactly that. Predictability, certainty, reliability, consistency. And the petitioner urges this court to overrule every reported decision in this state that's considered this subject. He asks you to overrule the Kruger case that this court decided in 1962. He asks you to overrule the Dallas Court of Appeals in Chopin. He asks you to overrule the San Antonio Court of Appeals in McGee. He asks you to overrule the Sawyer case out of the Houston Court and reverse the Amarillo Court in this particular case. I think to do so would create uncertainty and not predictability, would create confusion and not reliability, and would not provide any consistency. We urge a strict construction of Section 439A, and we submit that needs to. And I believe this position is supported by the enactment of Section 439A, and again the amendment of 439A. Both of which were legislative mandates that we needed clarity in this area. And I think the plain wording of the statute supports the position that we're taking. The legislative history cited in our brief under Section 439A supports the position we're taking. And the language of the account card is consistent with Probate Code Section 436
4 and 438A, dealing with the ownership of these joint accounts during the lifetime of the respective parties to the account. If you look at section 46 of the probate code, you will see the joint tenancies have not been favored in Texas, that they were probate code section 46, which is a revision to a prior civil code statute, abolished joint tenancies as generally in this state, but does permit that type of arrangement if there is a specific written agreement to that effect. And I would also point out to the court that both section 46 of the probate code and both section 439A of the probate code both say that a joint tenancy with right of survivorship account is not to be inferred from the mere fact that there's a joint account or there is joint possession of those accounts or joint ownership of the account during the lifetime of the respective parties. It's inappropriate to make that inference. For all of these reasons, we respectfully urge this court to affirm the decision of the trial court and consider the decision of the Court of Appeals of Amarillo.
Definitely have no questions. I conclude my argument.
Thank you.
Please, the court. Obviously, my argument missed its point. The response, I hope it ends with you. I am not arguing that effectively, Sawyer said, was incorrect in holding that for all evidence and was admissible in the presumption of case. My argument is this, my point is this, is
and I believe this position is important. The legislative history cited in our brief under section 439A supports the position we're taking. And the language of the account card is consistent with probate code section 436, 4, and 438A dealing with the ownership of these joint accounts during the lifetime of the respective parties to the account. If you look at section 46 of the probate code, you will see that joint tenancies have not been favored in Texas, that they were probate code section 46, which is a revision to a prior civil code statute, abolished joint tenancies as generally in this state, but does permit that type of arrangement if there is a specific written agreement to that effect. And I would also point out to the court that both section 46 of the probate code and both section 439A of the probate code both say that a joint tenancy with right of survivorship account is not to be inferred from the mere fact that there's a joint account or there's joint possession of those accounts or joint ownership of the account during the lifetime of the respective parties. It's inappropriate to make that inference. For all of these reasons, we respectfully urge this court to affirm the decision of the trial court and consider the decision of the Court of Appeals of Amarillo. The justice have no questions, but I conclude my argument.
Thank you.
Please, the court. Obviously, my argument missed its point. I am not arguing that effectively, Sawyer case was incorrect in holding that for all evidence and was admissible and the presumption was created. My argument is this, my point is this, is that throughout, from Kruger 1962 up to today, the words payable to survivor are evidence of intent. 439A says that to determine whether or not account is a survivorship, we must look to the agreement. And therefore,
are looking to the agreement and construction of the agreement, and when we construe the agreement, the intent of the parties to the evidence for that agreement is the primary consideration. As was stated specifically in the Amarillo Court in this opinion, as was stated specifically in the Chilton Court in that opinion, in that 439A in Chapter 11 does away with and makes in question as a matter of law as to whether or not it is a joint tenancy of rights and survivorship account. Therefore, the intent of the parties must be determined from the face of the agreement. And as I said, the intent of the parties has been determined from Kruger on that payable to the survivor was evidence of the intent to establish the survivorship account. Whether or not I have asked this court to overrule all those cases, the truth of the fact is that all of those cases that have been cited and discussed here today, with the exception of McGee and Chopin in the Stalker case, have held for the survivor. So, the Chapter 11 effectively overruled the prior law with respect to parole evidence. It did not overrule the prior determination of what the parties intended in the payable to the survivor. The words payable to the survivor was evidence of that intent. At the present time, there are a number of these old accounts parts active. The solution to this problem is to impose some kind of sanction on financial institutions to be responsible for their acts of opening up an account. However, 441, 445, and the banking code completely absolve financial institutions of any responsibility with respect to joint accounts. Therefore, those people who are opening up the account could care less what the effect of opening an account is. And the persons who are opening up those accounts do not know what the effects are. They're unschooled in what the effects are, except what a common layperson would construe those to be. And how do you transfer ownership of non-titled personal property? You transfer that ownership by transferring possession unless you have a written agreement to the contrary. When you hand money to another person, you transfer possession and you transfer ownership unless you take a note or you take back some other kind of evidence that was not intended to transfer ownership. When a common person a layperson looks at an account card and says that it is payable to the survivor and that the withdrawal of those funds are binding upon the survivor, the parties to that account, their heirs, assigns, and representatives, how can they construe that to mean anything else but that those funds are going to be owned by the survivor? That's the issue before this court at this time is, are you going to require a strict construction of these words and go contrary to the legislative intent and require magic words, joint tenancy of the rights of survivorship, are those exact words that are set out in the amendment 1987 to make a joint tenancy with rights of survivorship? And counsel has stated that joint tenancy of the rights of survivorship has always been strictly construed. That has been true with exception of bank accounts. And when you look at the cases dealing with bank accounts, the survivor always wins. When they have payable to the survivor, they say that's evidence and creates a presumption that can be overcome. It's hardly ever overcome. In the McGee case, which they decided to say that follows the Chilton case, it was a strict joint account, A or B, with no words available to the survivor. The McGee case is not on point in this issue. The point is, what can a little old lady with a $100,000 CD going down to put it in and afraid that she's going to get sick and wants her daughter on that CD, whether or not
it is going to transfer ownership of the funds or be a contingent account. And if she states on the CD that it is payable to her daughter on her death and that her daughter is to have those funds, is she to assume that she is giving those funds to her daughter outside her probate estate, or is she creating a convenience account? I submit to you that payable to the survivor, words alone, is consistent to be sufficient to transfer ownership, is consistent with all of the cases since 1962, and should be the law from this point forward.
Thank you, counsel. The foregoing cases are submitted on briefs and oral arguments. That concludes the business of the court for today. The marshal will please adjourn the court.
The audience, please rise.
Oyez, oyez, oyez.
The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned, subject to call.